Our latest edition of Soundtracking, in association with The White Company, features British writer-director Bart Layton. Bart won widespread critical acclaim for his debut, The Imposter, a documentary about the case of the French con man, Frédéric Bourdin, who impersonated a Texas boy who disappeared at the age of 13 in 1994. His new film is also based on an extraordinary true story about a group of ordinary, everyday guys who plan to steal the most expensive book in America. Unlike The Imposter, though, it's predominantly a work of based-on-real-events fiction with great performances by all of the actors in the central roles. But it's more complex than that, of which more shortly. Before then, a word from our friends at The White Company. Now, we all lead very busy lives, and I, for one, really appreciate a good night's sleep, what with being a working mum who always has plenty on the go. The White Company has years of experience in crafting bed linen and more to help us achieve just that. Think of them as your own personal sleep experts. They've now launched a brand new range of products to help you achieve the best sleep possible. It's not simply cozy engulfing bed linen and nightwear, but naturally infused sleep remedies too, which I've genuinely found helpful in steering me towards a peaceful and restorative night's sleep. To find out more, head to thewhitecompany.com or pop into one of their stores. Sleep better, feel better, live better with The White Company. American Animals is scored by Anne Nikitin, who also collaborated with Bart on The Imposter, and it's with her cue, The Real Day of the Robbery, that we begin. I should say that while we always try to avoid spoilers on Soundtracking, there are a few more pertinent details about the narrative than usual in this episode, as well as a bit of choice language. Welcome to Soundtrack, and thank you so much for your time. I'm going to set the scene actually first, because we are sat in the foyer of the wonderful Screen on the Green in Islington, London. I feel like we've got a whisper.
I know, it's posh.
Because people are in
well.
Watching your film.
No, they've got like glasses of wine and all sorts
you can
of
have
stuff.
Snacks. But what's really lovely is people coming in and out, and we can keep getting wafts of music.
So why are you going to the loo? It's like a really important bit. Yeah.
Listen, congratulations on American Animals.
Oh, thanks so much, and thanks for having me. It's weird when you do something that you actually listen to.
Thank you for listening. Do you know what I loved about the film? And I'd watched the trailer quite a lot of times because it was really infectious. And I'm a massive fan of Barry Keoghan as well. I think he's just, the bomb.
I love that boy. He's unbelievable.
But going into the cinema and being utterly surprised by the format of it. I don't want to give too much away for people because I want people to experience that as well themselves if they haven't seen it yet. That's a rarity these days of you going to the cinema and you get whisked away like that.
Yeah, and it's a bit different.
Yeah.
I think that was probably the gamble. You know, I made this doc, The Imposter, and, you know, and it had this unexpected life. And then I got offered some really big movies, and which was lovely and flattering and a bit bewildering as well. And then you have that thing of thinking, and you get sent these scripts and all the rest of it, and then there's that thing of, because you have to live with it for a couple of years, and you think, there's a point where it's like, is this a story, you know, I really need to spend like 2 years telling? And then, and I think I got to that point with a few of them, and there was one I was like really close to doing, and then had this moment of kind of about to get on a plane back from LA where I'd been having these meetings about it, and I thought, you know what, it's exactly the kind of movie that, even if I didn't completely balls it up, I'd probably watch it like on a plane. It wouldn't be something like, I need to see that. And so with this, it was really that thing of try and do something a bit different and find a new way of telling a true story that we haven't really seen before. And the gamble being that by mashing it up a bit without wanting to give too much away, but by including the real people who did this thing, which is sort of stranger than fiction, I think your connection with the story and with them as characters changes a bit.
Yeah.
Because you kind of have skin in the game somehow.
Yeah, definitely.
You ever feel like you're waiting for something to happen? It pains me to see you embarrass your father.
But you don't know what it is.
You're in, or you're out.
That thing that could make your life special.
You're in, or you're out. You're in, or you're out.
How can I tell you if I'm in or I'm out without you telling me the first thing about what I might be in or out of?
This would be something dangerous and very exciting.
This library is home to the most valuable book in the United States.
$12 million. You really need to see how easy this is gonna be.
Oh, you know this from all your previous heists?
Can I just say how dumb this entire thing is?
How do you know no one's gonna get hurt?
I don't want you waking up years from now wondering what could have happened and who you could have been.
Music's such a big part of the film, both in terms of this fantastic soundtrack you have of contemporary tracks that are kind of weaved in either, you know, as kind of incidental or part of the narrative, then this fantastic score that you have as well, and you've same composer that you used for Crime Impossible, Anne Nicotin. Is that how you say her
name? Yeah, Anne Nicotin, yeah. She's a wee genius.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, if we can talk a little bit about her first.
Sure,
And how you came across her and what it was about her work in particular that you, you know, worked with her on The Imposter and then took that on to American Animals.
I think I worked with someone that she worked with closely on some TV docs that we were doing, and then he suddenly wasn't available and he said, oh, I've got this young woman that I work with and she's super young, and I kind of thought, yeah, let's give her a go. And she was so kind of emotionally smart, I guess, because it's really interesting. Like, I wish I was more like musical, or I'd bothered to stick with like playing the piano or something, you know, and I have
we
this
all do.
With my kids and I was like, you really need to stick with this. And so the conversations we would have would be like, I would be saying things like, you know, those strings makes me feel like it gives him too much empowerment, or it gives him too much kind of, it feels triumphant, and actually don't we want to feel some sense of isolation, and what instrument would give us that? And we would have these conversations which were all about like like feelings and emotion, and then she would come back with the musical translation of that, and in such a smart way. Both of us had only really done non-fiction, you know, doc stuff before, so we were both sort of shitting our pants a bit with, like, me with like all of the stuff of like the actors and all of the hundreds of crew that were going to come, and and her with, you know, the fact that it is different. You know, docs have a very different way of using, you know, equally important but a different way of using music. And so because we have this sort of shorthand for the way we communicate about things, and we really get into it. And I always bring her on really early. Like, I send her the script when I'm still writing it, when it's still at the beginning, and then she'll start writing stuff. And in this case, she wrote things which were like ideas inspired by scenes that I was writing in the script, and then she'd send them back, and that would then influence my thinking about kind of the rhythm of the scene, or you know, how propulsive it might want to be, and then that in turn influences kind of the number of shots you might want. So it's a sort of weird you know, symbiotic thing, and so she's on really early, and then we exchange, you know, songs and tracks from bands that we love. And in this, there was this whole need to create four different themes for these four characters, and that was all kind of like, what kind of a person are they, and what were the movies that they would have loved, you know, and what is the soundtrack that they should have.
Yeah.
And that could be like a really orchestral thing, or it could be a really electronic thing, and there's both in this movie.
I love Warren's theme. Thank you. It's quite Laurel and Hardy at times.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's kind of...
Yeah, that was really inspired by... I found this crazy bit of music, which was from a really early Morricone film. It's Italian, and I can't even... The translation is, four sentences long. It's, this yeah. crazy Italian thing. It's, ode to a, forgotten man who's lost his... I don't know what it... but, it's this weird... sort of circus music.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and there's all kinds of weird bings and strings and it's all a little bit kind of out of time. And so that, and that seemed to suit Warren because he's kind of clown-like, but he's also deeply naughty and it needed that kind of yeah. Tim Burton kind of naughty.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's a couple as well that I pulled out that really kind of resonated with me. When you listen to the score away from within the film, and it's beautiful to sit and listen to as well as a whole piece.
Art I haven't really done that. I must do it.
You should.
I kind of need to sort of see what it does without the pictures. Yeah.
Art has to be more is beautiful. Build intention, there's this piece called First Plans,
yeah,
which kind of starts with that kind of almost kind of screeching strings that then goes into this almost, it's got that little nod to that kind of that kind of funky bass of sort of Ocean's
double,
type.
Yeah. Exactly. Thank you. the whole thing with the movie was like, because the idea, I suppose, was like that it's about kind of life imitating movies, and it's about these quite lost young men who try to inhabit a kind of movie fantasy for as long as they can, and they want to spend more and more time in that, and there's almost a sense that no one wants to kind of pull a ripcord and say we've gone as far as we should go with this, and we shouldn't cross this line, and so the idea with everything about the, whether it was the camera movement, the color palette, and obviously the score and the soundtrack, was to do with this idea that they start in something that feels naturalistic, so it's all quite pared back, and then as they get deeper into the kind of plotting of it, and they get deeper into the sort of movie fantasy, we should also move close to that. So we go from kind of electronic stuff and quite sparse and quite kind of, I guess, pretty restrained.
Yeah.
To, we start to bring in the instruments that you associate with the kinds of movies that they were watching and that they were sort of falling into, right up to the point where they're completely detached from reality, and we go in, and at that point, you know, as you'll notice, you know, we borrow expressly from a whole load of those movies, you know, whether it's Ocean's 11 or Once Upon a Time in the West, you know, we borrow not just actual tracks, but also bits of sound effects and things, because I wanted was that you would, that we all kind of become a little complicit in it, and we also get a bit lost in the movie. And at that point, you know, we're not hearing the real guys. We're sort of like, yeah, we should, we want to know what's going to happen when you go through with this. And then there's this point where they do cross the line, and the idea at that point was to go kind of really abruptly back into kind of documentary, naturalistic, and then she's done these amazing tracks, which are super prolific. And then we lose all the orchestrated kind of the instrumental stuff, and then we go back into stuff that feels more like electronic. There's this one, she's just called it Get Out, Get Out, Get Out, or something like that. And it's really like a proper balls out kind of, you know, like escape moment. But it's also, we've gone back to something that feels more raw and kind of unpleasant than the kind of fun movie that we were inhabiting before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. The story that you read about this real event on a plane to New York, is that right?
Yeah.
And then you were like, Scott, I've got to make it into a film. Was it easy to write? Was it quick to write?
No, it was weird because there wasn't really a template for it, because I was writing to the guys who at that point were in prison. Fortunately, I had plenty of time on their hands for correspondence, and they would write these, they had a limited amount of papers that they'd write these scrawled, tiny writing, and there were four of them, so I had like four
new
different
pen pals.
Versions. Yeah, new pen pals. And then that's how that's how I started writing the script. And I was doing it in a pretty, like, because I'd never written a screenplay before, and I thought, I wonder how this is going to turn out, and I was doing it kind of cheekily, a day a week, while Dimitri and I were running this company. And then it just sort of, like, that's the thing, you create these characters and then they start having lives and conversations. And so that was easy because I already knew who they were as real characters.
People.
But the tricky bit is that, you know, most true stories just do not fit neatly into a Hollywood structure. And I guess that's why they end up getting really, there's a lot of artistic license. And I felt like the thing with this was, not only should the real guys be in it in some way, but actually we should be slavishly kind of restricted to the truth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I would show it to other friends who were like what I considered to be like proper screenwriters, they would go, well, this is easy, you just need to lose one of these characters, and why don't you combine that guy and that guy, and then it all makes it easy. And I was like, well, no, because the idea is they're going to be in it.
Yeah.
And so I wrote the script with the voices of the real guys based on what they said in their letters, and I figured when they finally came out of prison, we'll sit down, we'll do the interview, and they'll say basically a version of that.
Yeah.
And of course they didn't at all. And so then I was like, oh shit, I've sold this script, and I've promised everyone I could. But what you, the thing you don't want to do is then try and get your documentary characters to suddenly deliver lines or start performing.
Because, feed them stuff.
Yeah, because then the thing that they're supposed to do, which is bring that authenticity and naturalism, just evaporates. Yeah. So then I had to call up and go to the producers, go, didn't go exactly to plan, and can we pause everything so I can rewrite the script around what they actually said rather than what I thought they were going to say. And a lot of what they did say on the day was better. It was just different from what I'd written.
Did they ever talk about music with you?
Yeah, I got them to compile playlists for each of the actors. So like, and it was more like,
great.
What were you listening to at the time? And so, because there was this whole thing about how like the actors really wanted to hang out with the real guys.
Yeah.
The real guys were like 10 years older. Most of that time they'd been in prison. So they were very different people.
Yeah.
And I felt like they're also likable. And I worried that they would, you know, they were going to get together with the actors, and then Warren, you know what Warren's like,
yeah.
Right? He would sit down with Evan Peters, who was playing him, and he would say, listen, just don't make me out to be too violent. And I just wanted the actors to be completely sort of liberated from any of that stuff. So what I said was, well, and I showed them the bits of the doc stuff that I'd already shot, and then I was like, well, why don't you create playlists for each of the guys who are going to be. And they were all really different, and they all were really, you know, obviously it's not surprising, but they were really kind of emblematic of who each of them were. Yeah, then, you know, Chaz, who's like super jockish and has got a very conventional like music taste. And then there was Eric, who's a little angry, and he was into actually kind of stuff that I guess I was into, which was all like the Pixies and all of that sort of stuff.
Rage.
And very much so, you know, and he was an angry young guy. And then Warren was like super sort of eclectic, you know, and everything from, you know, like, I think, he had Tom Petty, and he had like Joni Mitchell, and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, it was really unexpected.
Were you able to use any of those songs that were on those playlists actually in the film then?
There was one which kind of inspired a moment in the film where, so I would go, like, if I was getting, you know, like, stressing out in the build-up to, like, the movie and stuff, because the whole thing was, coming from Docs and doing this, which wasn't a massive film, but it was quite big, given that I had never been on a film set before, really. So I was, like, in a full-on flap about the whole thing and felt like...
Well, you can't tell.
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks. No, but my reaction to it was to just, like, completely over-prepare, like, and storyboard everything. And not that I showed it to anyone, but I would go for, like, a run, and I would listen to their playlist. And then this song came on, which is this Q-Tip track, you know, Breathe and Stop. Yeah, and I was, the thing I was thinking about was the journey to the robbery. And actually, that bit of the score was written by this Mexican composer called Camila Baldi, who I met at the Skywalker Ranch. And
hold on, you were at the Skywalker Ranch?
Yeah, that was bananas.
Oh my God,
yeah.
So jealous.
Yeah, that's a bonkers place, yeah. I was.
Oh man.
I went for a run round the lake they have there, this incredibly beautiful lake.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is amazing, this lake, it's right, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, he just built that lake a few years ago. It's like, what? Yeah, apparently he was like, George Lucas sort of looking out his office window, and he was like, you know, and whether this is true or not, but it's one of the long standing guys in there. He's like, you know, what we really need there is a lake to go with that mountain. So, and it's called Ewok Lake. I think the rule is you're not really supposed to talk about it once.
It's like Fight Club, basically.
Yeah, but it is really nuts. And you know, and the whole tech building where you do all of the sound mixing and everything is he's based it on a Tuscan vineyard, on a villa. And so you go, and so from the outside it looks like this amazing aging Tuscan winery. And it looks old, and he's had the bricks flown in from God knows where.
Oh my
and
God.
Then you go in and they've got the most high-tech shit you've ever seen. In the basement is like this 600 seat state-of-the-art cinema. Wow. When we were there, they were mixing the last Star Wars. Yeah. So there was a whole like section that you weren't allowed to go into. So that was obviously where we were trying to
I've heard so many people on the podcast who have had various experiences at Skywalker Ranch. Garth Jennings talked about staying there when he was doing his animated film Sing, and he was like, I felt like I was 12.
And they have bikes everywhere, so that's like, you kind of like they just leave bicycles for you and you zip about the place and might bump into someone like fabulous.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Anyway, you were telling the story about Camilla.
Oh yeah, so she wrote this one track, which is The Journey, and it comes out of, so Barry Keoghan, he is like the greatest fidget on the planet. Like, he does not stop moving around. And we were shooting this scene where they're waiting for the car to come to take them to their house when they're all dressed as old men.
Yeah.
And he was fiddling with these little, it was like a salt and pepper shaker on the table.
Yeah.
And I said to him, why don't you just start beating out a heartbeat on that?
Yeah.
And it will really piss Evan off, who's stressed and, you know, we're in this very tense moment. And so out of that beat that Barry starts, we wrote this kind of, I say we, what am I talking about? Camilla and obviously Anne got involved as well, you know, wrote this thing where out of that starts this kind of this bass line.
Yeah.
Then we start adding in these other little tension bits, and then the windscreen wipers go on,
yeah.
And we bring that in. And then as they're shutting the door, there's these beeps, so we bring those in. And so all of these little sounds that appear start adding into the tension. And then I'd always loved that scene in, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West with the thing swinging, you know, that amazing noise.
Yeah.
And so I found a pencil sharpener that I then put a version of that noise, which obviously doesn't really fit the pencil sharpener, but it fits the terrible kind of churning feeling of when you're that nervous and the sound of a clock is ticking louder than you ever can you remember hearing it, and then this pencil sharpener, and then all of these, you know, and the squeak of the gloves on the thing, you know.
Yeah.
So that was a moment where the sound design, which is done by an amazing guy called Andrew Sterk and Paul Davis, who do most of Lynn Ramsey's stuff, and, you know, just a couple of geniuses.
Hmm.
So that's where the sound design and the music start to become the same thing.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. But there was a moment where I was thinking about how that was going to be so incredibly tense. And then this Q-Tip track came on, and I was like, this is so the opposite. And I was thinking, well, maybe it'd be funny if while they're on the way, he puts the radio on to try and break the horrible tension.
Yeah.
And then this track just comes.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're like, oh, we're in a totally different movie. It's all cool. And now it's like, it's got this killer bass. And then just as quickly, you know, the other guy turns it off. And so occasionally you'll hear a track and it will spark a whole idea for like a little moment in the movie. And in this case, not because it fit, but because it didn't fit.
Yeah. Well, the contradictions, I think, sometimes work even, even better.
And I think you get, you know, a lot of the scenes in this, you know, I wanted them to be kind of bordering on being comedic and also tragic as well. And one benefits the other in a way. If you can get a comedic moment in the middle, you know, then you can kind of up the tension, or if you up the tension more, you can get a better laugh. At
You know,
so they kind of sit kind of weirdly complimentary sometimes. A hard time if your motion is still. Let me move some things around because the lyrics is ill. Abstract, you know my sticky D in here. Get on and swear it's f***ing yeah. But yo, your girl just moved to the joint in the club, in the car for crew. Bruh, look, the movement.
repertory of thongs. I get my rhyme on dust, guaranteed to make it right if your night is a bust. You vibrant and you fresh and all original to say the least that you've impressed. Come on, come on. Rapping start that they stall, finding it very hard to make it over the wall. Hey, get your weight up, my motto you heard, and I go to death here to felonious words. So girls, move it around. If you see your main dog, give your brother a pound and just breathe and stop for real and give it what you got and just breathe and stop for real and give it what you got.
We were talking just before I hit record, actually. We're talking about how you can sometimes fall in love with a track that can be dangerous for various reasons. And I've got the soundtrack list here, which I have to say is absolutely brilliant. There's a real mix of stuff. I had it on, it's really funny, I had it on in the car this afternoon as I went to pick my 10-year-old up from a play date. And I'm glad it was just him and not the 5-year-old as well, because he's definitely inquisitive about language at the minute, you know, especially in music and F-bombs and all that kind of thing. But this is just the most brilliant collection of songs that's on the American Animal soundtrack. Where do you start when you're trying to place known music?
Sometimes it's written in the script, and sometimes there are things that you will kind of feel are totally on the money in terms of not just the rhythm of the scene, but the kind of emotional value. I never worry about the lyrics. Like, the lyrics often are so counter to what the, you know, like, for a long time I had that Fleetwood Mac track, Secondhand News, in for their arrival in New York. And that's a song about, I don't know what it's about, but it's not about good things, as I remember. But the emotion of it is so up and empowering, and it's like it had this, it spoke to this whole thing of like newness and the thrill of the new, you know, they've never been to out of Kentucky before. And all. And also, you know, the, I guess it's probably on the nose for an American audience, but you know, that kind of back in the New York groove also had that thing, but it's also propulsive in a way that is very useful for cutting to. So there were things that I was thinking of specifically, almost kind of shooting the shots that I felt would, you know, there's a moment where there's a cymbal crash and I would shoot a woman, you know, throwing water into the gutter, you know, in Chinatown with the express view. Well, that will work beautifully on that cymbal crash and things like that. But then, of course, like you say, what happens is then you go and find out how much it costs and it's like, oh, fuck. I'm going to say someone has taken my place. When times go bad, when times go rough, won't you lay me down in the tall grass and lift me in my stuff? I know I got nothing on you. I know that there's nothing to do. When times go bad, you can't get enough. Won't you lay me down in the tall grass and lift me in my stuff? When I think about some of the weeks of editing, there was weeks given over to trying to replace tracks that I'd fallen in love with, like the Doors song, Peace Frog, which is a song I remember, you know, having on in the car with my dad on, like, you know, long trips up to Scotland and things like that. And there's something super modern about that track, you know, that it doesn't age. I always thought it's really similar to, like, there's the same riff or whatever it is in that. Is it the Soup Dragons? You remember I'm Free?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's that. It's got this kind of propulsive, super cool. And the weird thing is, like, everyone comes out of the cinema going, what is that track? And because it's not like a
it's
one
not
that
one
everyone.
Of the big Doors
it,
tracks,
and it
yeah.
doesn't have that their classic kind of keyboard thing going on in the same way. But that was a perfect example of, like, they turned around and they were like, that's going to be 180 grand or whatever it is. And we were trying to explain, we're like, you know, it's not the Avengers. And that's the thing, if the band aren't around to be able to go to them and say,
it's lawyers,
can you
it?
Just watch this? And if you dig it, well, let's do a deal. Dead blood in the streets, it's up to my ankles. Feet blood in the streets, it's up to my knees. Feet blood in the street, the town of Chicago.
Sadness.
And that is what had happened to me in the past with The Imposter, with Bowie and with
How did you get Cat Bowie? Steve.
Just sending the film and the clip, and writing and begging and saying this, and also writing and kind of explaining why it feels like it speaks to that moment in the film, and the whole spiel of gushing, but also sort of trying to make your case, I guess.
Yeah.
But then if the artists aren't available, and like you say, it's lawyers or it's the estate, and the only thing those guys are interested in is money.
Did he say what he thought of the film?
All I got was that he was willing for us to...
Great, that's all you want.
Yeah.
I'm up on the 11th floor and I'm watching the cruisers below. Down on the street and it's dry hard to force us to flow. Oh, my heart's in the basement, my weekend's at an all-time low. Cause she's hoping to score, so I can't see her letting him go. Walk out of her heart, walk out of her mind. Oh, not her, she's so sleepy.
They arrive in New York as well. There's a real musical shift almost of kind of like, or it's almost like musically you're dropped in New York.
Yeah, and that again is
so
like that
clever
thing of, and also like the colour palette changes, because it's like we've been in this sort of stultifying world, and it's that thing of suddenly they're in like a movie scape and they go under the L train, you know, from the French Connection, and then they go through China. You know, it was all of those references. Since someone pointed out that New York groove was used in another movie, and you know, for an American audience, it's maybe too on the nose. But I was like, God, that is like, isn't that how you feel the first time you ever go to New York? It's like, whoosh, here we are.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like you're on a movie set.
Yeah.
Totally.
Many years since I was here. On the street, I was passing my time away. Buildings towering to the sky, it's out of sight in the dead of night.
Maybe that's a thing of being a Brit and thinking in a slightly different way. And, you know, people have commented that there are songs in the movie which have been in other films, and that was kind of partly the point.
A little less conversation. It's like, it's a real, like you talk about when you were explaining it earlier about the whole point is that they feel like they're in a movie, and and that's just such a clever way of doing that as well.
Yeah, and
everyone associates
and
it with.
You know, they talked about watching Ocean's 11 over and over again, and Warren even talks in the movie about how there aren't manuals on how you plan a heist, and so they go to Blockbuster and hire.
Yeah.
The thing about them is that if they'd watched them to the end, they would have figured out that they all pretty much end really badly, you know, and they didn't quite get that far.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really want to have a little less conversation. It was one that, you know, we shot this sequence, which is their fantasy of how it's all going to play out, and it was supposed to be this kind of, and it's this single shot, and it was going to be seen. And then the editor, who was back in London for the crew when we wrapped, he was like, put this on. And he put the track on, and I was like, oh, it's so obvious. Even though we were kind of, it was a pastiche of Ocean's 11, I was like, but that, it just stuck. Because it was like Gentlemen Thieves, it just worked so well.
It so does, in the right way as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I got an email from Soderbergh because I'd written him asking if we could use a clip from Ocean's 11. And we just didn't hear anything, and I sent in the script, and there's a clip from The Killing, and and the idea was that they're going to be watching this sequence where George Clooney is explaining the plan, and then there's these cutaways of Matt Damon and all these guys, and then suddenly there'll be cutaways of our guys, and it would be like they're in the same room kind of thing. And anyway, we never heard, but I just got an email saying, they fucking loved the film. So, and obviously appreciated that we'd made these little references to his movie as well. Yeah.
Nice.
Like, shit, giving us the clip, man.
Yeah. Anyway. Getting really long at replying to emails, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart and maybe satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Baby, close your eyes and listen to the music. Dig to the summer breeze. It's a groovy night and I can show you how to use it. To come along with me and put your mind at ease. Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Shut your mouth and open up your heart. And baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby.
Did you think about the music shift or the music shifting when it was fact or fiction? You know, in terms of, was that something you spoke to Anne about at all? About?
Yeah, kind of. There's a handful of scenes in the movie where you kind of don't know whether they really happened or, you know, we've got unreliable narrators and we've also got, yeah, to say the least, right?
I love the ambiguity of at the end, though. I kind of, like, I think it's the, yeah. It's
so
brilliant.
Right. So coming back to that, so that ambiguity of like, how much of the fantasy did he kind of fabricate or create? So the scenes that were kind of basically narrated by Warren, which was sort of his version of what happened. So when he goes to Amsterdam and he meets him. So we shot those very specifically. It's a movie within a movie kind of thing. And those were the ones where when we scored them, the idea was to really go large in movie. So there's that track where, I'm not sure what she's called it, but where he goes to see the counterfeiter.
Oh,
and it's
kind
of got a Morricone sort of like, it's dark and there's an oboe, or it might even be a bassoon and it's got an old school Morricone feel, you know, so, because in Warren's mind, he's constantly in a movie. He's like, and at that point, he's in a Western or he's in a film noir, you know, so those were the kind of things. So than the non-fiction because the game was, you know, the financiers were so like freaked out about the idea of putting like why you can put doc stuff in what could otherwise be quite a commercial movie. I didn't want to flag it up too much. I wanted it to kind of be seamlessly coexisting in the fabric of the movie.
So it's your first screenplay you've written. You've got to have a taste to do more of this type of thing, though, because it just feels...
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think once I got past the anxiety, you know, because that's... I think the thing that... The moment I finally relaxed was when we got to rehearsals and these amazing actors show up and then they start breathing life into this thing you'd written. And I'm not the kind of... You know, I know a lot of writers, they sort of sit at home and they like stand up and act it all out, or they get someone else to.
Yeah.
And I just can't bear that. So I don't do like table reads. I feel it's like such a bummer. So I didn't know until they showed up that the words that I'd written were going to sound real. And then actors do this kind of amazing thing they do. And it's like alchemy. It's like, wow. And so. Suddenly you watch them and there's not any bit of you which thinks that that was something you wrote. It's like they own it, and that was when I was like, oh, okay, this probably is going to work. And there's a lot about Docs which is magical, which is that you don't really know where you're going to end up when you when you start on the journey. And with fiction, you know, when you've got script and you've got that crew and you've got that pressure of making the day and getting, you really have to know where you're going. You know, you really have to know, like, super well. You know, if people are standing around on set and time and money is ticking by and you're like, let's see what happens. You know, it's that's not a nice place to be.
What did the boys think of the film?
The real guys. They really, I mean, you know, there's a lot in it that they're still deeply ashamed of, obviously. And but they I think they, you know, they're really behind it. They felt it was true to their memory of it. You know, the interesting thing about this is that what starts to happen is that the movie, and this happened with The Imposter as well, the movie starts to kind of replace their memories. You know, so their memories and the movie start to get all twisted. They can't remember what's what now, you know what I mean?
I had this conversation with someone yesterday. I was asking someone what their earliest memory of something, and they said, well, that's the weird thing, because I don't know, and I think that the memory that I have is not my actual memory. It's based on a picture or conversation that I've had about something.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Totally.
You've created a new reality for them.
Well, I mean, you know, and yeah, I mean, you know, it's so weird, isn't it? Like, I remember with The Imposter, you know, the sister ended up thinking that we had shot in all of the actual locations that it had happened, and I was like, they don't exist anymore, and, you know, but in her mind, that had become her memory of it, and, you know, memory's this really fragile thing. You can kind of not erase it, but you can almost overwrite it with something else, and you can. I heard a mate of mine at a dinner party telling my story, like, of something that happened to me, as something that happened to him, and I was like, what, Tom, that isn't your, that didn't happen to you. And he was like, yeah, it did. And we had this big argument. I was like, where were you? And what? I was like, I told you this, and it, but in his mind, it was all from his, you know, and he remembered it visually and everything, you know.
Yeah,
you've stolen my memory, man.
What's next? Do you know?
I'm just kind of finishing a script for, and it will be the first thing I've done which is not a true story at all. But it's actually no more outlandish than either this story or The Imposter or whatever. And it's, but it's also set in the Deep South. It's somewhere between like Fargo and Funny Games. It's like a twisted, it's a kind of extortion caper that goes not quite to plan, but it's really, there's a whole Trumpian kind of element to it, because it's about a charlatan that no one really wants to believe is a charlatan. They want the version that they want to believe, you know, which is, this seems like this whole relevant thing, you know. And so I can't say too much about it, but it's an amazing story, and I guess the challenge with that will be to get the audience to engage with it almost as if it were a true story.
Thank you for your time.
Oh man, it's such a pleasure. I feel like I've just garbled on.
No, it's been amazing, and congratulations on Americans. I can't actually wait to go and see it again at cinema, to be honest, because I laughed a lot as well. There's some really great funny moments in it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's such a bonkers story, isn't it? Yeah.
But yeah, go see it. It's wicked. Bart, thank you, mate. Cheers.
Oh mate, thank you for having me.
That's I'm Alive by Johnny Thunder, rounding off our latest episode of Soundtracking with Bart Layton. in association with The White Company. My huge thanks to Bart for taking the time to talk to us. American Animals is on general release now and is quite unlike anything I've ever seen in a long time. It's bloody brilliant too. Now we'll put up a Spotify playlist for this show, as we do with every episode, you can find via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes. The aforementioned Mr. Soderbergh is amongst the wide range of guests. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do keep spreading the word on your socials. Next up is another Soundtracking Live, recorded a couple of weeks ago with Irish director Lenny Abramson, who joined me with key members of his team, composer Stephen Renix, editor Nathan Nugent and producer Gail Egan at London's BFI to discuss their latest film, The Little Stranger. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.